Somehow I had always thought that you were a Southern writer. I guess it was Tender Mercies and Civil Wars and so forth.
But that's the wrong Tender Mercies. I better get that straight before we go on the radio. That was the movie, which had nothing to do with my book. And people make the confusion all the time. You can't copyright a title, and the title comes from the Bible anyway. So, you know, I couldn't even prove that Horton Foote had stolen it, because he said he got it from the source. No, people are always asking me, what was it like to meet Robert Duvall and so on, but my book had nothing to do with it. It came out earlier, you know, before the movie. So, but, yeah, I do have another book or two from the South, though, so, you know. Civil Wars and a book of poems, right?
So. But then I began reading the Rose Allen Brown Reader. And
discovered,
you have some very illuminating essays in the book, and I found out a whole bunch of things I didn't know about you.
And that the South is a borrowed place for me, like most of the other places.
Well, let's work up to before and after. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about your background and some of the elements that might have led up to your being a writer. I know that... You were born in Philadelphia, and you were raised, I guess...
I was raised around New York. Philadelphia barely really enters into my biography. We
Mount Vernon, I think you said.
Skipped town after 10 weeks of my life anyway, right? The sort of central years of my childhood I think of as in Mount Vernon, New York. And, we moved around a lot for no particularly interesting reason.
What did your family do?
My father was just had various jobs as purchasing agent for textiles and so on. I mean, there was no particular reason for, and it wasn't that he couldn't keep a job. I know we sound sort of feckless and irresponsible moving around a lot, but there were coincidences. I was born at the end of 10 years in Philadelphia, for example. And so we left town. You know, I think my parents were sort of waiting at the city line for me to be born, just on their way out. But it did start us on a life of a lot of, moving around. And I write about that a lot. I think I write about people who don't belong anywhere. And I'm obviously working out my own obsession. I have one book, Cora Fry, a book of poems with a kind of story in it and characters. And she belongs in one town in New Hampshire and can't get free of it, in fact. So I think I was testing what it might feel like to actually be in a place you can't get out of rather than not to belong anywhere.
What kind of family was it? A literary household?
No, my parents read, but neither of them had even been to high school. They were from a generation when people really, you know, went out to work very early. My father, who just died a couple of years ago, was born in 1899. I just recently saw statistics, and it's astonishing how few people actually went to high school in 1910 or 11, which would have been the time for him. It was an astonishingly small number of people who actually did that. So he didn't, and my mother also went right off to business school and out to work. And they read, and so I did grow up with a household that respected books, and they certainly never frowned on my becoming a writer, but I wasn't picking up on anything that anyone else in the family had done. We had no one in our family who had gone to college before my generation, let alone... I did have a brother, I should say, who was a jazz drummer. Until a few years back, and in some ways I think he might have plowed the path that allowed me to do something as odd and unlucrative, maybe, as becoming a writer.
What sort of a child were you? Because it would seem to me that...
Very serious.
I was going to say that there has to be something in a child's psyche that would make him or her adopt a lifestyle that is so... solitary and so isolated.
Well, I think you've touched on something. I was in the course of moving around a lot, I was pretty lonely. At one particular point, when I was about 9, we moved to Los Angeles for what turned out to be just a year. It was a little experiment that didn't work. I found myself desperately needing friends before I had made any new ones, and I ended up spending that year beginning to write. Which I find kind of interesting because I tend to think that most writers write out of a sense of solitariness or alienation. Not all of them, but most of them, I think, are trying to fill some kind of hole.
How old were you at that point?
I was about 9.
About 9?
Yeah.
Do you remember what you were writing?
Oh, I do, yes. It's such a funny thing. It's very much a girl's thing, too, and I don't think this has changed, even as sexual politics have changed. I was writing those horse stories that are famous among girls and D.H. Lawrence, actually, you know, where you dream about a horse that arrives outside your window for your birthday, and it's a beautiful black stallion with a white star, and you give it some wonderful romantic name. Those are the sorts of things I wrote. And I wrote, I didn't know that Rin Tin Tin was a dog. I thought it was a place. And I wrote a poem called In the Wonderful Land of Rin Tin Tin. And my first story, which is really funny to contemplate, I sort of stole some mystery sections from a classic comic and put them together and called it Murder Stalks at Midnight. And I remember that my oldest brother, who's the one who was the jazz musician, laughed and told me that, I don't remember if it was Lionel Hampton or who it was, some jazz person had a piece that was called Celery Stalks at Midnight. And I had no idea that I had chosen such a cliche. I was crushed. But this was obviously had been used before. So that's how I started writing, and then I thought I'd be a journalist when I was a teenager. I thought I'd put this to some good use, some practical use, but fell in love with poetry in college. In fact, my freshman English teacher taught us how to write sonnets, and so I thought, this isn't too difficult, and I wrote one, and I sold it to the New York Times, which at that point was publishing very bad poetry on the editorial page. And so at 17, I had a poem about Thomas Wolfe in the New York Times, and I thought, piece of cake, which of course it hasn't turned out to be.
But that's really, at 17, that's really 17. An accomplishment.
Yeah, well, I started publishing fairly early, actually, and I didn't find it that difficult. I think
were you writing short stories?
No, I didn't. I never wrote. I wrote one story in college, and then never again until I was in my early 30s, and I had already published a book of poetry, and began somehow to inch toward fiction. I sort of had enough of myself and wanted to write about others. So, and I somehow didn't understand that you could do that as a poet. I don't know why. I guess I had done it a little bit, but I felt more comfortable then telling stories.
Well, your background as a poet would seem to be a wonderful background for a fiction writer, because it makes you look at words and structure,
yes,
and images, metaphors.
Absolutely, and I wish more prose writers had begun as poets, because they might write with more attention to all those things. I mean, I hear my words when I read things aloud to myself, and I listen to the cadences of the sentences, and every word means a great deal to me. I think there are too many prose writers who approach their work as if it were journalism, and that the words themselves don't mean all that much. You've just got something to say, and you say it. And I think it's... I really do love the sound of the words. I love to play with the words. I'll revise and revise, listening to long words, short words, length of sentences. And, you know, it doesn't just sort of burble out the way so much contemporary fiction does. I can't promise that that makes it better, but it means that I hear it a little bit differently from many.
You went on to college, Barnard. Mm-hmm. You must have studied English.
Studied English. All I wanted to do was write, really. I kind of regret that, actually. I'd learned a few other things.
Well, how did you expect to support your writing habit?
I didn't really worry about it much. I thought I'd, you know, either go to graduate school or go into publishing, which seemed to be the two possibilities. I wish I'd become a biologist or something and learned to write on the side, but...
You wish you had become a biologist?
Not so that I wouldn't write. I wish I'd learned something else along the way and then had awakened, you know, at age 30 writing, but of course that's the dream.
You know that somebody who studies biology is not going to be a writer.
It's unlikely. Here and there you run into people who manage two things at once. You know, Ethan Kanan, for instance, who's a medical student, manages to write pretty terrific
stories
and novels.
Student?
He is. Well, I don't know. Yes, maybe forever.
Seems to me I talked to him 5 years ago, he was a medical student.
Right.
Well, that's not inconceivable, I guess.
Yeah, well, there are a few people who manage to combine them. Of course, you know, it's an idle gripe. I'm very grateful to be doing what I'm doing, actually. And I only went to graduate school because I couldn't think of anything else to do. And we were a class of writers or would-be writers, and we dropped out one by one. This was before the days of writing programs, you know, so we were having to become scholars and didn't much like it.
You became a teacher.
I did become a teacher, but I became a teacher of writing, which is a little bit different from being a scholar. And I really try to teach people how to read, and I teach a craft. It's really technical what we teach. Many people don't understand that. They say, how can you teach writing? They think we're teaching talent, which of course we're not, because that you either have or don't have. But there are an awful lot of questions of craft that you can learn, you know, by analyzing what others have done.
Well, somewhere along the line you got married, and I believe I read either in some of the publicity material or maybe in the essay, that you went to Mississippi with your husband. Can you tell me about that experience?
Yes, I can. We went down to teach in a black college. They were called black colleges then. I guess they'd be African-American now. To do our bit, really, for the civil rights movement. It was the very beginning of 65. In fact, when we went for our interviews, it was just at the point in the summer of 64 when the three civil rights workers were missing. And we did that because we wanted to take part in the civil rights movement, but we were really rather cowardly, I suppose, about taking full part. We really were terrified of plunging in and carrying picket signs and being jailed and so on. We shouldn't have been, but we were. And I've always been careful to distinguish, for people who've read Civil Wars, between my experience and the experience of the people in the book who were real heroes of the civil rights movement. We certainly weren't. But we did what we could, and we were there to kind of give testimony in a way. And we were there for 3 years, and I wrote poems about Mississippi, which became part of my first book, Some Deaths in the Delta. It was a very, very significant experience in our lives. It really turned us around in a lot of ways, defined what we think of as important. My husband, who had been trained as a clinical psychologist, really gave that up and went into something much more publicly oriented. Now he's a teacher, but he went through a lot of years as a community organizer and did a lot of things that seemed more useful on a large scale than being a psychologist and dealing with one person at a time. You know?
How did the experience change you?
Oh, I think it changed me by forcing me to ask myself a lot of questions. One of the things that Civil Wars tries to deal with is what are the determinants of how we see the world politically? You know, how do children grow up? One might say brainwashed, or one might just say kind of trained in a kind of moral atmosphere. It pits against each other two kinds of families, one in which the children grow up as real little segregationists, and one in which the children are the son and daughter of ex-civil rights workers. And it shows them trying to reconcile, shows the little segregationist kids trying to reconcile what they've learned in their own household with very, very much more liberal feelings on the part of this family that they have to move in with. And the reason for that is very complicated, but it doesn't matter. Questions like that intrigued me, you know. My own children grew up in a family that was open to many kinds of experiences, and many of our friends, you know, were of many colors, for example. And I would see kids who couldn't deal with that, and I'd bring it on home and ask, well, what had their parents done to foster an atmosphere in which these kids were comfortable with diversity versus those who were not? And that's the sort of thing I think I had to think about. My own family was one that was politically engaged and taught me very early, I think, to be more than tolerant. So that sort of thing has been on my mind. And even in my new book, that Before and After, my newest novel, I really end up putting up against each other questions of family versus community and individual love of your children versus the law, all those kinds of questions. We had to ask those during civil rights times. Could you break laws with impunity? What if you did that for good reason? Was there such a thing as cause? You know, if you got yourself arrested, was that good? Depended on what it was for.
Yeah, I guess there's a feeling that you're not quite sure what's right, what's wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, it was easier, certainly, when you were being arrested in Mississippi. You were sure you knew what was right and what was wrong, but a lot of things have gotten fuzzy since those years, haven't they? Things were very black and white, if you will, and they're not anymore.
Back to you. You all during this period, you were writing and raising children. How were you able to balance your commitment as a mother with your desire to write fiction?
Well, I think probably I give a great deal of credit to my husband, who always appreciated the fact that I was a writer. In fact, I swear he married me because I was a writer, and I've paid him back by typing for him in all the years since then. He can't type. But he was very insistent on my need to protect my time so that I could write. And we always made choices on that basis, really, of, you know, whether we would have babysitters even when we didn't have any money, when we moved to one of the particular, we lived in two towns in New Hampshire, and when we moved to the larger of them, Peterborough, which is really becomes the town Highland in my book, my new book, he was absolutely adamant that we find the town in that area where he had taken a job that had a daycare center, because I really, he knew that I had to protect my writing time, and there was no way to do that without having a place for the kids. So he's always been marvelous about that and absolutely necessary to my capacity to do all these things at once. And, you know, it isn't always easy. It really isn't. But my kids learned early that there were times when I needed to be by myself, and they tried to stay out of my way. I did have one wonderful, funny thing happen when my oldest daughter was about six. She was in first grade. And I remember she came home from school one day, and I was just finishing typing up a passage, and I said, "Just a second, honey, I'll be there in a minute." I hated to be doing that while they were home. I thought I could usually finish by the time they got off the school bus. I said, "Just wait a second." And she stood and watched me. And I said, "I'll be there." I felt very guilty. "I'll be there. Just take off your, you know, your snowmobile suit and get there some milk for you. And I'll just give me a second." And she stood and she watched me, and I was feeling terrible. And I finally turned to her and I said, "Will you please?" And she said, I said, "What are you doing there?" She said, "I just want to see you working." Because by definition, when she was there, I didn't do it. And she was very curious about what it was that I was doing, but she could never catch me at it. So she finally was very happy to actually catch her mother doing this thing that she was always protecting. And then, of course, I did work when the kids were around, never on my what I call my own work, but all the other things that come in with a writer's life, writing reviews and writing blurbs for books and judging contests and a million other things. I always ended up doing them at the kitchen table with everybody swirling around me, you know, trying very hard to concentrate. It was not easy, but clearly I had a lot of conflicts about moving into the other room when they were home.
Well, I've talked to writers and children of writers, and there seems to be some confusion if a writer works at home. There's some confusion within the family as to what the writer's actually doing, whether it's a male or female, because most people go off to work.
Right, exactly. Well, you know the story about John Cheever, that he used to get into a suit and go down in the elevator to the laundry room or wherever, next to the laundry room where he worked, and he'd work all day, you know, out of the suit, presumably, and then get back into it and go back up in the elevator so that he'd look like a working man. There's a confusion. I'll tell you, the hardest part, though, isn't your own children, because you can explain to them. And if you and your husband both respect your work or your wife, whatever, they will learn to pretty much stay out of your way most of the time, unless they terribly need you terribly much. The problem is other people. It's friends and it's business associates and people that you really have to train not to call you, for instance, at your prime time hours. Well, I finally have an answering machine, and I try to screen my calls. And I know people get angry because they know you're back there, but I'm trying to work. It was easier in a small town, actually, to sort of train people up, you know, to not bother me if they could help it. That's hard, because people see you're at home, you know, and the carpool calls you and says, "Can't you take the second grade kids to the movies today? We need a carpool driver." And you say, "But I'm working." It's much easier if you're a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, whatever, and of course they know you're working. They would never dream of bothering you, but, oh, she's just a writer. You know, she's home.
Well, in your latest novel, Before and After, you set in New Hampshire, and it really is a family-oriented novel and the commitment to family members to one another. And there's a lot in there about the criminal justice system, too. You must have done quite a bit of research on the
I did, yes. I was very eager. First of all, I needed to know a lot, but I was also very eager to get it all right and not make mistakes. I think readers these days demand that you know those facts, and, you know, they can easily turn to Scott Turow or someone who's a lawyer to be sure that it's all correct. So I had to be very careful about making sure I understood procedure. It's not a procedurally heavy book, you know, but I did have to be quite sure I understood, you know, what comes first in the very complicated system of prosecution and so on.
Well, I'm not sure Scott Turow would know necessarily all of the criminal aspects. For example, you have a lawyer who is not really a criminal expert, and he believed that you had to go to the border of Massachusetts to receive the prisoner.
You know, the way I found that out was that I talked to a friend who was a judge, and he told me that that was the situation. And then when I went to the Cambridge jail, I believe it was, and I asked, they said, "Nah, we used to do that, but we don't do it anymore." So he wasn't exactly wrong. He was just out of date. and I wrote them both in because it was an irresistible scene. I believe it's, I can't remember if it's the mother or the father, but whoever imagines their son being taken from the jail to the border and then handed over to the New Hampshire police. And that is the way they used to do it. It just isn't done that way anymore. So, yeah, there were all sorts of things that I had to get right, which was interesting, of course. It's always wonderful to do sort of field trips. You did them when you were a kid, and this gives you a right to do them as an adult. And people are terribly nice in those circumstances. You show up at the jail and ask for some help, and everybody's very happy to help you.
You mean they don't say, well, what are you doing?
Well, they do. In fact, the sheriff in Cambridge, Massachusetts, said to me very gently and delicately, well, Rose Ellen, have you published anything? You know, before he was ready to help me, he wanted to be sure I was a writer in earnest, and I thought I should have brought some of my books to prove that I was there in good faith. So I nosed around a lot. I knew that I was going to have members of this family in jail. I wasn't quite sure which ones, but somebody was going to end up in jail. I say that because in the case that sort of vaguely inspired the situation for me, there was a case in Houston, the details of which didn't interest me, but there was a quite extraordinary situation, this was quite a few years ago, in which a boy was accused of murder and his parents refused to give the evidence that they had to the grand jury. And they ended up in jail at one point, and the boy was home on bail. They were in jail for contempt because there is no law that protects parents from having to testify if they have evidence against a child. You are protected against having to testify against your spouse, but not your child, which in some ways feels unnatural, although these are really outgrowths, I think, of slightly different conceptions of responsibility in the law. And I was fascinated by that. I thought, what could get us to the point where the parents would be in jail and the child would be at home? And it doesn't work out quite that way in my book. When I went back and wrote a story, you know, to move them to that point, I changed things a little bit. And so this pits husband against wife, really, in their interpretation of what has to be done to protect their son. I've forgotten what I was saying.
Well, that's all right. Let's go on.
I've just come to a complete standstill.
That's okay.
What was I saying?
It's interesting that in the family, in before and after, there are four members of the family, and in effect, the family becomes split over the crime that Jacob, the teenager, is accused of committing.
Yes.
And yet they somehow remain intact. Now, that's very unusual.
Yeah, it is. I thought we hear so often about families coming apart when terrible things happen. And they do very often for reasons that are understandable. Sometimes there's only so much a family can take before it cracks. But I thought in this case, not just for the sake of novelty, I have been say at one point very late in the book that they have congruent wounds, that no one else could understand them not having gone through this. And somehow this family still fits together because of all they've been through together. And what happens is very complicated. This story's simple, really. You know, child is accused of murder and parents have to decide how to deal with him. But, of course, the playing out of that is not going to be simple. And by the time we work our way to the end, they understand. Each of them understands why the other has taken the course that he or she has taken. They don't always approve of it, and they give each other an incredibly hard time. And they're very angry, but they know that this has been done out of love. And I think in the end, one of the reviewers said that this was my most affirmative book, and I thought that was very interesting. And I think this is what he meant, that at the end, they have been dragged through all this together. They've had to confront what they don't know about their child, about each other, about their town. And when they've come through it, they understand that everything that's been done has been done out of maybe what they think of as a misinterpretation of duty or whatever, but that it's all been done out of love of Jacob and the desire somehow to protect him. One of them, I won't give too much away, but one of them feels that the protection can quite rightly consist of hiding evidence, lying to the lawyers, you know, refusing to testify to the grand jury. One of them decides that does not do Jacob a service, that in fact he needs to acknowledge what he's done and somehow pay some kind of price for it, because the dead girl's parents have paid, the dead girl has paid, and there needs to be a kind of reckoning. And that parent, note how careful I'm being, I've heard that people are reading this book, you know, as a kind of suspense novel, so I don't want to give anything away. That parent really does believe that the proper course is the one that actually looks like a betrayal to the other parent.
Well, there's another character that's more significant than you might think, and that's Judith, mm-hmm. the daughter, who
12-year-old
actually
daughter.
Becomes the conscience of
yes.
the family, doesn't she?
I think a 12-year-old is probably, it's easier for her to be the conscience of the family than anyone else, because a 12-year-old's sense of justice is still so pure and so uninflected and so untested, and so she has a very strong sense of right and wrong, and she pleads with her parents to do what she considers the right thing, which is not to lie. It's a little bit like, you know, it's interesting. When I was in Mississippi, we discovered that a great many of the people who were there with us in the civil rights movement were children of ministers, rabbis, whatever, their children. And it was very clear that the reason for that was that they had listened to their father's sermons. In those days, it was mostly fathers, or maybe a few mothers now who are ministers, and had taken them at face value. They took them literally. And they, when they said, you know, that your life should be one that's, you know, somehow devoted to everyone's participation in American life, they said, yes, that's right. And so they went and fought for it. It was a fairly simple thing to decide. And I think for Judith, there's that same sort of almost religious, it isn't religious in her case, but it's that sort of purity that says, here's right, here's wrong. Also, by the way, I'm so humiliated, you know, she says, by what's going on here, because at that age you want your whole family to be just transparent. Don't attract any attention to you. Don't draw any eyes to yourself. And she can't, of course, like any child, she can't stand the fact that her brother is in everyone's minds and people are imagining what he and this girl were doing and how in the world could this have led to murder.
Well, it's tough living in a small town like
very
that.
Very tough.
You don't have the anonymity you would have.
Absolutely.
In
and
Houston.
In fact, I moved them to Houston at the end because I hate to have done this to my Houston friends, but I think any city could be a surrogate for Houston here. It's a place where no one much cares what has happened in your past. I use it as a kind of counter to the small town where even things that you haven't done in your past are held against you. If your family did them 2 generations ago, everybody says, oh, well, that Smith boy, what can we expect of him, you know?
What's it like for a writer living in Houston? You haven't lived there too long.
Oh, I've lived there 10 years.
Ten years.
I have, yeah. But although we go back to New Hampshire every summer where we used to live, it's hard to be summer people, but we have a special place because we did live there for a very long time. My children grew up there.
It's good to go to New Hampshire in the summer and escape Texas.
Very good thing.
I grew up there when we had no air conditioning in the
40s. I can't imagine. And did you flee at an early age?
My family did go back to Ohio, and I stayed north, and subsequently they went back to Houston
really?
Where my
well,
father
well, now there's air conditioning.
And they are still open. Yeah.
It's a lot easier.
We had screened-in porches.
Yeah.
We ran barefoot.
Yeah.
But you said in one of the essays, I can't remember how you phrased it, but indicating that Houston was a rather unlikely place
it's more unlikely for people from the East who don't understand how in the world we could be surviving there. It's, in fact, a very congenial place. It's an easy city to live in, provided you don't live at the end of a freeway and have to commute, and we don't do that. We live sort of in the inner city. It's an easy city to get along in. There are a number of writers. They're very supportive of each other.
Is there indeed a literary community?
There is indeed. Yes, there is. You know, the famous communities, artistic communities in Houston are the opera and the ballet and the symphony, which are, as they like to say, world-class organizations. Although I always think that a really world-class city never uses that word. Paris doesn't and New York doesn't. London doesn't. But be that as it may, the literary scene actually has some wonderful people on it, and books are taken seriously enough so that my last book, Civil Wars, it came out in 84, I shared a book party with the writer Max Apple. We had about 200 people at that book party. We danced in the parking lot of a bookstore. And
there were some great bookstores there, too.
There's a couple of very good bookstores. And it's an active and lively community. And the best thing about it for a writer is that you're not the 80th writer on your block the way you are in New York. You know, you all sort of stand out. You attract some attention. Most of it is benign.
Do you get a lot of local press?
You get a lot of local press. You do. And you read from time to time.
And you're teaching at the University of Houston.
I'm teaching at the University of Houston, right? Mm-hmm.
And you must eat a lot of Mexican food.
I do. I love it. Well, we have all sorts of, now we have Mexican and Vietnamese and Indian and so on. But, yeah, the Mexican is the only kind that I refuse to eat anywhere else in the country.
It's much better than it is up here. It's so heavy. Where in Houston do you live?
We live in Montrose, which is the, I guess people call it the artsy section of town. But it's right near downtown. And the nice thing about a city like Houston, unlike New York, is that you can live in a house and be 10 minutes from the center of the city. You know, you can live in a house on a green street, and most things are low-rise. It has its problems, but there are many more virtues to it than anyone realizes.
Are you going to be setting a novel soon in Houston?
I don't know. I've wondered all this time why I haven't written about it, and I don't really know.
You've only been there 10 years. You're practically a stranger.
But it was interesting the way I brought it back when I, the very end of the book, having brought it back to Houston, I ended with something that I had actually, what gave me the idea was that I did a piece of journalism once. I wrote an article for the New York Times Sophisticated Traveler section, the supplement, about Houston as a port. My editor there didn't know that Houston was a port. She insisted it's an inland city, and I said it is, but nothing holds back Texans, right? It's 40 miles inland, but it's a very, very major port anyway, nonetheless. And for that article, not only had I tooled around the ship channel and other polluted places, but I had taken a canoe ride down the bayou that starts way out in the west and comes in towards town. And you can take a canoe all the way down through the most unlikely green places that no one even thinks exist. A couple blocks from Neiman Marcus and Macy's, you know. There you are in this green channel, headed all the way downtown, and you come down between the huge buildings, and there you are in this waterway that no one ever thinks of as a river. Bayou is just a narrow, deep river. And this was so interesting to me, it was really entrancing, that I wrote it in as the last scene of the book, where the family, having been battered and torn, rides down the bayou together. I've written a number of books that have water catastrophes in them. Nothing terrible happens at that point, but then everything terrible has already happened.
Well, I know you have a plane to get, so we'll wrap it up. It's Before and After. It's a beautifully written book and most enjoyable, and it was great having the chance to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much.